are 14 individual magnets, with the north and south in the radial direction. In other words, all the odd number of magnets would have the north facing the center of the ring. The even number of magnets would have the south facing the odds and evens would have north versus south facing toward the center. So you've got 14 individual magnets on the outside. In the inside, you have three separate coils offset by 120 degrees each. The electronics fires those three coils, each one of the coils one at a time, in either the positive direction or the negative direction. So the electronics selects which coil it's going to fire next, and is it going to fire it positively or negatively. And when you study the fact that you've got three positions in positions on the coils in the center, followed by the fact that each one can be magnetized positive or negative, you've got the equivalent of 12 positions on the center, correction, six positions on the center, 14 positions of the magnets on the perimeter, and it's all set up in such a way that you slowly slide from one a homing position, so to speak, to the net. The reason why you have a crazy number of magnets on the outside versus the inside is you want to limit the amount of ratcheting. As you turn the propeller on one of these model airplanes, you do feel some ratcheting action of those magnets, but it's nowhere near as severe as it would be if all of the magnets on the perimeter of this ring lined up with all of the individual coils in the center. The nice thing about this is there's no brushes anywhere. You put 100 amperes of 30 volts across that motor at any one instant of time. That's where the 3,000 watts is going into this thing. And it's turning out very close to 4 horsepower in the process. It's a fairly elaborate chunk of electronics that senses what position the propeller is in at this instant of time. It knows when the zero crossing occurs because you're sliding from one magnetic position to the next, and it knows when it should fire the next magnetic coil and in which direction. And you select by way of your radio control command what rate it does this, which sets the revolutions per minute. It is a kind of synchronous motor. You can tell it, I want that propeller to spin 2,125.5 revolutions per second, and the electronics will do that for you exactly the same every time. Very, very fancy thing. They're running 90-some-odd percent efficiency, no brushes to replace, no oil from the motor to clean up after you've flown the airplane. Really a marvel. We're now at the threshold, in my opinion, where the total power output from electric airplanes is considerably greater than the total power output that people have used with gasoline-powered engines on their radio-controlled airplanes. Up till now, about the highest power that I've ever seen is a so-called chainsaw motor, which I think runs around 1.5 or 2 horsepower. I saw many of these helicopters flying at close to 4 horsepower. I saw one particular plane flying at 13,500 watts, 13.5 kilowatts. If I did the calculation, 746 watts per horsepower, that's probably around 18 horsepower. That plane, that the, what was it now, 51 P-51 Mustang, was flying at 18 horsepower, electrically powered. I'm guessing that was a 25-pound airplane, and the thing can move easily 100 miles an hour. That's a remotely piloted vehicle. That thing's a weapon by my standards. Wow. That thing got power. So you're starting to see some very fancy motors these days. You study the difference between an electrostatic motor and a magnetic motor. You rapidly come to the conclusion that the magnetics can give you a lot more force than electrostatics. That's the reason why electrostatic motors are an interesting curiosity, but they've never caught on. They never will catch on. But modern-day magnetic motors, wow, can they give you power, small size, high horsepower, high reliability. They run cold, and you can't beat them. So I think you're going to see an ever-increasing number of electronic flown airplanes, purely electronic, no gasoline or methanol, alcohol or whatever, or nitromethane. I think that's going to slowly decrease in popularity. It's not going to disappear. there's always going to be some guys hanging on to the older technique for whatever reason. But these electric-powered aircraft are silent by a long shot, except for the ducted fan versions. They whine. They spin up at some crazy number like 40,000 revolutions per minute on the ducted fan electric motors. What I'm describing now is the so-called NEAT fair, N-E-A-T, that was held up in, I think Madison is the name of the town that it was held in about a month and a half ago when I went to that event. Very interesting event. Anyone else with any further questions or comments on Paul's sensor for his Thunder automobile, give us your call, letters, and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2KY, one more thing, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, Mel.
Just curious, this magnet, as I described it, a flat magnet, about an eighth of an inch that it would thick, about an inch and 2 inches maybe in diameter, the hole in the middle, got glued to this aluminum disc in this motor. What kind of material is that made out of that it will shatter easily if you drop it to the floor? And is it magnetized in the after it's molded, or is it magnetized, is the material magnetized at the beginning of the mix, Dick, over?
When they magnetize it, I'm not sure. But right now, the strongest magnets you can get by are the so-called neodymium magnets. I think they're called neodymium iron cobalt, but I'm not sure about that. But neodymium is a rare earth that now can make super strong magnets. I'm now holding on to a magnet. If I just let go of it, and it presses up against the metal rail of a rack that's in front of me, this magnet that I removed from a disk drive, whenever somebody throws out a modern-day computer disk drive, if you want to take the time to take it apart, you'll find a pair of magnets inside. To say that they're strong is an understatement. Those things are potent. I'm talking now about the magnet that moves the arm that selects the head position. In other words, you've got a bunch of heads that get pressed against the disk, and you want to very precisely position those heads, and there's a magnet which is the equivalent of a Dawson valve movement. In other words, the magnet that moves the needle on an old-fashioned milliammeter. The modern-day version of that is what's used inside of a disk drive to move the head assembly. And those are really potent magnets. And also there's a very beautiful ball-bearing assembly with the circular motor that spins the disk itself. Another very precise set of motors with no brushes, with you can see how inside of a disk drive you require extreme cleanliness. You don't want any particles in there that are beyond a micron in size. Otherwise, the head would be hopping over those particles and you'd be missing data points. So the smallest chunk of dust, if you smoked a cigarette in the factory where you assemble those, the little particles of smoke that come out of your... The smoke that comes out of the cigarette really consists of a whole bunch of fine little particles. If any one of those particles ended up inside, the disk drive would probably be damaged in a matter of time. So you can see how the bearings must be made in a very sealed manner so that no metal particles comes out of the bearing. It's got permanent lubrication, a darn good set of seals on that, and there certainly couldn't be any brushes on that motor. It's a brushless DC motor that does the rotating in a very precise manner, and this really potent magnet positions the head. You take apart a disk drive, and if you do it carefully, you'll end up with a set of magnets that are, you wouldn't believe how strong they are. In fact, you've got to be careful what you put them here. They could erase your credit cards. They could, you put them near one of your cassette tapes, they could erase that. If you put it near a television set, I think you could do some damage to a television screen. You would create some permanent magnetization of the mask assembly of the television screen. So you've got to be careful what you put them near. They're really potent. Anybody with any further questions or comments? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Joe, can you
meet you
in the UK? You got a comment?
Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, Dick. One of the places I worked for, PMI Motors, had the type of motor you were describing a little different. The armature of the motor was a flat circuit board, very thick, depending on the current they wanted to use, and it had maybe about 30 or 40 points around the edge of the around the circumference that were tied together, so you could have as many as 40 different armors, different coils, maybe one at a turn that would go around, and the that was the stationary part. The rotating part, the armature, actually consisted of a rotor with magnets, and we used samarium cobalt magnets, and depending on how fast you wanted it to go and the accuracy of speed, it goes to 4, 8, 6, or 10 of them. And I worked on one particular motor they were used, in a submarine for pumping air, and we had to be going up to about 15,000 RPM, and the magnets flew apart. The only thing that happened is the glue didn't hold, and they flew apart off the armature, and it sounded like an explosion. We took the motor apart, and the magnets were disintegrated. But we used samarium cobalt. They were a very powerful, very powerful motor with that.
Yeah, in the old days, Alnico, aluminum, nickel, cobalt, Alnico magnets were considered pretty strong. Then came samarium cobalt, a whole lot stronger. And now it's neodymium, iron cobalt, I think it is. Neodymium is now the super strong magnet. If you go to Radio Shack and you buy these tiny little round magnets that they've got in a bubble pack on the shelf, you'd be amazed how strong those things are. And those are neodymium. In fact, I think the package says so. Neodymium is now the latest thing in magnets, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find by the time they start doing further studies of high-temperature superconductors and so on, they're going to find some more magnets. Magnetic fields are capable of producing some very nice motors when they're assembled correctly, and the high-torque motors have the magnets flying around the outside, and the stationary coils are on the inside. Sort of backwards the way it used to be with a motor that had a real commutator. The coils were doing the rotating and the magnetic field was on the outside and it was steady state. In other words, it didn't rotate. Now you could say the motor is built inside out. It's a hell of a lot more efficient, a lot higher in torque capability, and lots of progress is being made on the electronics that drives these things. Really fancy. Let's see. I'm going to give a quick standby, see if anyone else with any questions or comments. If not, we're going to go over to Bell's lecture number 3 on the subject of Smith chart use in order to do impedance matching of a known mismatch of an antenna. What I think Mel's going to tell us is that if you know your antenna is a 25-ohm impedance because you put a pair of 50-ohm elements in parallel with each other, he's going to tell you right where to put the stub in order to get perfect impedance matching. You'd be amazed how easy that is to do once you understand the principle, and it does it with extremely high efficiency. So before Mel starts his lecture number 3, anyone else with any further questions or comments, speak now. And I just suddenly realized I better let Paul give us a quick talk also on what's going on with the space shuttle. But let's first find out if there's anyone else with any questions or comments. Give me a call, letter, and name right now.
WB2HWW with a question on this subject.
Howie recognized. Anyone else? You got it, Howie.
Yeah, Dick, are these new motors, how clean are they as far as putting out noise on the power line? If you hook, like in the old days, when I used to build radio equipment, I would use 110-volt fans. I never liked to use 12-volt fans to put them on, fans, are they much cleaner today?
Much cleaner. The coils, first of all, the 12-volt motors of old days used to have real brushes, and the brushes made noise. And it took an awful lot of filtering to get rid of the brush noise. Your old-fashioned drill motor, you run a drill motor near a sensitive radio system, and boy, you're going to hear some real raspy static inside of your radio, coming out of your radio when you run that hand drill. I think it's just a matter of time before hand drills are using some of these modern motors. These modern motors have no mechanical commutator. It's a purely electronic commutator, where which coil gets the current is being switched by way of field effect transistors. Now, the waveform by which you switch the field effect transistors can be a ramp up of current and a ramp down of current. It's not a sudden connection and disconnection. So if you control the current waveform that you put into each of the coils, you can make that motor as quiet as you want even before you do any filtering. So if the design is right, these modern-day motors, in my opinion, are capable of being noiseless. The best example I've got of that, Howie, the fact that I watched this airplane fly, a P-51 Mustang, 13.5 kilovolts of energy was going to the motor during its flight. A very sensitive radio receiver was on board, by which the pilot, standing on the ground, half a mile away, the airplane flew at least half a mile away from him from time to time, half a mile away from that airplane, he's giving commands with a one-watt transmitter, half a mile away, into this yucky antenna, a little piece of wire hanging out of the back of the airplane connected to the receiver. If that 13.5 kilovolt motor made any kind of a raspy noise, he would have been jamming the living daylights out of that very sensitive radio, and he had no desensitization. So these high-power, modern-day brushless DC motors, I think, are capable of being extremely quiet. Over to you, Howard, for any further comments.
Yeah, I know that. Now, like, you know, when I order amplifiers, when I used to order a Henry, I always got 110 volts fans. Everybody looked at me. I never liked to run the fans on the same power supply or same bus that would drive all the equipment. You think the motors you can buy today, like in computer places, and you run them on 5 or 12 volts, that they would be clean enough and you wouldn't have to really worry about putting noise, let's say, on your equipment?
What you're really asking is, are the modern-day designed motors capable of being quiet? Without a doubt. Now, if you buy the least expensive motor that's in a bubble pack on the shelf, and it's a 5-volt or a 12-volt or a 15-volt motor, is it also going to be quiet? I think the answer is no, but that's strictly between you and that designer. The technology to make it quiet is there. And so, is that inexpensive motor, brushless DC motor that you can now buy, is it of that design? I would give you an 85% chance the answer is yes, it's going to be quiet. But there's going to be some inexpensive manufacturer out there that's using some kind of a switching technique where he's cut some corners and he's got a sharp, spiky voltage going to the coils, and it's still going to be creating some noise in your electronics. I doubt it, but it's possible he's going to fall into that trap. When in doubt, make some tests, and whoever out there is willing to make a test for us and report back to the TechNet, we'll give you the good guy award of the day. Anybody with any further comments, give me your call letters right now.
K2KY. Mel
recognized. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, well, I'm using a number of these little one-inch fans on my radios. They were salvaged from computers that they mount right above the CPU to cool them down. That's how modern we've gotten with electronics. And we have to cool down solid state quite a bit now. And they have to put a fan on top of an IC. So I salvage these fans. You know, they're little 12-volt, 5-volt fans. Now, the one that goes on the CPU, I think, is a 5-volt. The other one's a 12-volt fan. And I've used them a number of different places. Actually, I have one right on the radio here that's right on the heat sink. And doesn't create any kind of noise problem whatsoever. I have another one on a 12-volt little version of it. And again, very, very small thing. You know, I'm sure you've seen it. It just snaps on to the top of the IC. I've used it on a number of radios and on the heat sink just to pull the heat away from the heat sink. And because these radios, this is another thing that they do. They use, you know, the cabinet is part of the heat sink. So it's very handy to use these little fans to reduce the temperature of the cabinet deck over.
Very fine, Mel. I got one other comment here, Howie, and that is these brushless DC motors, even though the well-designed ones have a ramp-up of the current that goes to each one of the coils with the proper timing in order to rotate the motor, still there is a slight discontinuity of current versus time to power that motor. In other words, it's not completely drawing steady-state current like a 5-ohm resistor would, so to speak. Therefore, if your voltage regulator is not a very good one, you might still see a little bit of ripple. Even though it's not making radio noise directly, it might make ripple of the 5 volts or the 12 volts. That's really a function now of how much filtering you do on it and how good is that voltage regulator. I'd like to believe that some of the modern-day three-terminal, better-designed voltage regulators, particularly when you hook them up with the so-called feedback capacitor technique for noise cancellation, I'd like to believe you're not going to run into a problem there. But it just takes a little bit of care. Now, let's go over to Paul, Paul, I know that they just scrubbed yesterday the space shuttle launch, and I think it's because the sensor that indicates fuel level inside of the hydrogen tank, and there's two or three sensors, and I believe at least two of those sensors of the three have failed. I have the impression, I'd like to know a little bit more about this if you do, about why that sensor is so critical. I have the impression that if the sensor that tells you whether that the tank is becoming empty, if it fails, and if you run out of the fuel going to the engine, I have the impression that something terrible happens to the engine if you don't shut down the engine before the fuel is exhausted. There's got to be a little bit of fuel left in the tank in order to save the engine. I'm guessing that a turbine will overrate and go to a high RPM and destroy itself, something along these lines. I bet you've got a lot more knowledge on that than we do. For the US-2N, for our space report, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Okay, yeah, the engine cutoff sensors, they had problems a couple of years ago. When Discovery was trying to take off, Eileen Collins' flight, I think, was the first one they really had a big problem with. And there were delays. They were worried about the foam. But meanwhile, this problem kept creeping up in a couple of different flights. And it would delay the missions. You would pump fuel into primarily the hydrogen one. They seem to always have problems. With, I don't remember them having problems with the oxygen sensors, but there's four sensors in each tank, and according to flight rule, three have to be working. Once you get down to two, that's it. Then they have to actually get rid of, they have to pump out all the fuel, see what kind of reading that they have, and then if it's okay, they pump it back in again. I thought they would have had these things straightened out, especially with the new external tank that they've been using. They're slightly redesigned because of the insulation problem on the outside of the tanks, which kept breaking off and hitting the shuttle, causing the Columbia disaster. I thought this would have been redesigned. It's like a low water cutoff in a boiler. You know, if you get too low, you want to be able to shut it down. You don't want to have fuel going in, and then at the very end, the fuel. You're really flying on a controlled bomb. You could have the controlled explosion. Really, is what you have coming back up through the fuel lines and into the tank, and you would just blow up whatever is left. You don't want to be attached to a shuttle if that happened. So if you had any kind of leak and you lost fuel, you're attached to the tank in your shuttle, the last thing you want is to have, run out of fuel and still have these engines running. Now you're riding a bomb, a potential bomb. So they want to be able to have these cutoff switches shut the engines down if you have a low fuel condition. Problem is that they're getting erratic readings. You look at the thing, it's all filled up, and they run a test and it's showing it's dry, or when it's dry they're showing it's wet. That's not reliable.
Okay, now the sensor in the hydrogen tank is the one that I think failed, or two of them failed. The hydrogen tank, in theory, contains no oxygen. I'd like to believe that pure hydrogen is not a flammable mixture. It's got to be a small amount of oxygen mixed into it. So flame traveling back through the piping to the hydrogen tank is a hypothesis. I'm not so sure that's what it is as to the failure mechanism. I was listening to a NASA report in which they were getting right down to the point of explaining what was the danger if the fuel runs out while the engine is still running, and then somebody just had to talk to me at that instant. I couldn't quiet them down, and therefore I missed the information. I'm guessing that you've got some extremely high power, high RPM turbine pumps that are pumping the fuel at an extremely rapid rate into a pre-igniter assembly of some kind, and then eventually into the real nozzle of the jet engine, of the rocket engine. And I'm guessing that that turbine is running at a very high RPM with a lot of back pressure, and if it suddenly sees a lack of liquid hydrogen going into its vanes, it becomes unloaded, instantaneously go to an extremely high RPM, and fly apart and become shrapnel, is my guess. I wonder if you've heard any failure mechanisms along that line. I know they want to make sure that the rocket engine is shut down long before the fuel runs out. WS2N, K2RIW.
That sounds possible if the thing doesn't blow up first. Well, you've got the hydrogen lines acting as cooling lines, too. Coming down, going around the, you got the bottom of your three main rockets on the shuttle. You've got the black cones sticking out of the back. Well, those engine cones, divert the exhaust downward. You've got pipes actually surrounding the each cone. You could see them on there when it's sitting on a launch pad before launch. You can see the smoke coming out of the out of certain areas. Well, some of those areas that it's coming out of is it's the effect of this liquid hydrogen that gets bled off right before launch. So it's acting as a cooling line, from what I remember reading in the past. If that cooling line shuts down, everything that cooling line is cooling down, including the main pumps, will all of a sudden become very hot. It's a recipe for disaster, Dick. So, shrap metal, I guess, would be. I don't know what would occur first. I would think that the overheating of the exhaust system would probably be number one, Dick.
You've got another good point there. So, rat racing the turbo pumps, and it's the hydrogen line that goes through all of those good-sized pieces of tubing on the rocket engine itself. The nozzle of the rocket engine is using the hydrogen fuel as a heat exchanger fluid. And so you're heating the hydrogen fuel from the liquid to the gaseous state in the nozzle. And so the nozzle of the rocket engine, if it's not being cooled, my guess is it would melt down in about 3 seconds, because you probably have a flame front there that's running at, I'm going to pick a number, 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. It'll melt any metal you got if it's not continuously being cooled. To your knowledge, Paul, is only the hydrogen used to cool the rocket engine, not the liquid oxygen? Only the liquid hydrogen is used as a coolant? Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, if the hydrogen leaked, for any reason, you've got this exhaust coming out, it's going to be burning off like crazy. Yeah, to use the oxygen line, I think that would you'd have a more of a tendency to have an explosion, with that, if that ever started leaking. I could imagine the hydrogen line leaking through and just burning off with the exhaust that's coming out. But, you add oxygen to the wrong place, you're going to get displacement in where some of the thrust is coming from. You could probably throw this whole thing off course. I guess they probably want to use the oxygen, because, like I said, the cooling lines come down and hydrogen lines before they feed the fuel to the system. You've got to understand, it's a takeoff. It's a piece of it. You're coming down with a 17-inch fuel line, and it's not like the 17-inch line breaks up into a million different lines and goes through the circulating cooling system, and then they rejoin and go back into the chambers to be mixed with the oxygen. You've got your main 17-inch line coming from your hydrogen line and from your oxygen line. That's what attaches to the shuttle. Two doors that close You'll see the two doors closed in the back of the shuttle when these two 17-inch lines separate. Well, those two 17-inch lines do go directly to the firing chamber of the three rockets after passing the they do have to go through the gigantic pumps that pump this fuel into the chamber. But you know, they have T's coming off here and there, and it's used to cool down the auxiliary pumps that they use, the three pumps that they use. The other lines definitely go down around the cones of the engines. They're takeoff, so they are. If any of those lines break, I don't think you'll have any kind of a real disaster. But if, you know, if it was oxygen, I think that would definitely cause a problem back here.
You brought up a very good point. Liquid oxygen and oxygen that has just boiled off from the liquid state to the gaseous state, I think, is an extremely corrosive material that would probably be eating into the welds of the tubing that's around the nozzle itself is trying to cool. And yes, any break in that line would be a very dangerous condition. Whereas hydrogen itself, like you said, if you break one of those lines and start leaking a small amount of hydrogen into the nozzle, it wouldn't make any difference. And hydrogen leaking off, even if it catches on fire, the fire tends to be a fairly safe fire. It's a very light material that wants to rise and wants to leave the area, so to speak, if you had a fire on the pad. So I could see how liquid hydrogen is more likely being used as a coolant and not the liquid oxygen. Okay, so for coolant reasons, and I'm going to guess the temporary rat racing of the turbo pump are the main reason. You want to make sure the engine is shut down before you come to the end of either one of the fuel supplies, oxygen or hydrogen. Quite an elaborate engine. I'm amazed how complicated that thing is, and yet it had rather good reliability all these years. I know that you were mentioning the fact that the last word sent back to Earth from Apollo 17 is, let's get this mother out of here. In other words, in astronaut talk, what I think that means is that we are scared to death at this engine that has never been fired, at the engine that lifts the lunar module off the surface of the moon. That engine has never been fired, and if it doesn't fire at that instant of time, at the right instant of time, with the right amount of thrust, it's game over. They're going to live out the rest of their life, which won't last for many more than a day or two, on the surface of the moon. And so they were rather worried about that one on each one of the Apollo missions. That engine really had to go. That's probably one of the most critical portions of the mission. Okay. I think it's time we hear a little bit about now the Smith chart, that very famous thing. I think it was invented roughly 1938 by Mr. Smith. I think he was working at Bell Labs at the time. When you read Theodore Marino's book on microwave transmission line techniques, he's got a rather nice section that gives you a medium good explanation. From time to time, QST Magazine has had some explanations of the Smith chart. I know there's a very nice section on the Smith chart if you go to the appropriate chapter of the ARL antenna book. So when it comes to properly using transmission lines, and there's all kinds of magic in what you can do with a transmission line, it's kind of hard to believe that you can have a rather minor perturbation in the load on the end of a transmission. If it's a 50-ohm characteristic impedance transmission line, and if you have anything but a 50-ohm resistor at the far end, if your load is anything but 50 ohms resistor, even if it's got just 5 ohms of capacitive reactance along with the 50 ohm of resistance, you're going to have a significant amount of energy not absorbed by the antenna or the load and reflected back down the line. And Mel's about to teach us how you put the right kind of a stub, which means a T connector and a short piece of coax cable going off to one side with either a short or an open. He's probably going to favor the short. A shorted piece of transmission line with a T connector mounted in the right position, the right number of inches or feet back from the antenna, makes all the antenna mismatch go away. And the rest of the transmission line is happy. It thinks it sees a purely 50-ohm load. And that T-connected stub, you're about to find out, is good to multiple kilowatts. It's It runs at extremely high efficiency, probably 99% efficiency, will take kilowatts of power, and makes all of the impedance mismatch, at least at the design frequency, go away. And if you want to be really smart, there's ways of putting multiple stubs and maybe even making it a broadband match. But we will go there tonight. We'll be happy just to find out how to do it with one single stub and create this magic. K2KEY, K2LIW. You got it, Mel.
Okay, good evening again. Now, all this is K2KEY. The only question I had before that I didn't get an answer to is this magnet that we're talking about, this material that they make these magnets out. I even see it in speakers now. This mix, is it magnetized when it's in its molten or liquid form, or is it magnetized after it's cast a dick over?
Yeah, there I'm not sure, Mel. I am guessing that many of the magnets are magnetized after they're constructed. The reason I say that is almost every magnet has what's called a Curie temperature. That means that beyond a certain temperature, it loses its magnetic field. And the very high temperatures that are used for making some of these materials, I think, are above the Curie temperature. So I think a lot of the materials, you cast them, mold them, wait till they cool, and then magnetize them. And the actual magnet that can magnetize these magnets is an electromagnet. You mount your magnet that's unmagnetized into the pole piece, and then you hit this magnet with a fierce amount of current, and it makes a magnetic field that would knock your hat off. A buddy of mine used to do alignment of a MRI-like machine. Nowadays, they're called magnetic resonance imaging. They used to be called nuclear magnetic resonance. It's the exact same machine. They just renamed it. But the nuclear magnetic resonance machine that they make for doing very high-quality testing of exotic materials, not intended for human exposure, some of these machines run as high as 2 Tesla. It's an extremely strong magnetic field. And this buddy of mine had his head near that magnet while he was doing the alignment of the machine. And whatever the magnetic field, whatever effect it had on his body, he told me, whenever he was doing that alignment, he would taste the fillings in his mouth. The fillings gave off a flavor that he could recognize. Maybe it's just his imagination, but I know that there are people who have died because they have put their head inside of an extremely strong magnet. And they're really doing themselves electroshock therapy when you do that because of the eddy currents here. The blood supply inside of your head is a highly saline solution. It's highly conductive. So by Lenz's law, you make a rapidly changing magnetic field inside of a human head, and your head becomes the secondary winding of a transformer, and you're producing all kinds of voltages, of course, across those poor neurons, and you're going to see psychedelic effects, and you go too far with it, and you're going to actually get some damage, as if you're doing electroshock therapy. So very strong magnetic field. Don't put your head inside of one of those. Treat them with tender love and care. I think they're at least as dangerous as a high-power RF field. So my best guess is magnetization after forming, but I haven't really researched it, now. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. In fact, just recently, they said they have found evidence that a number of people that have taken MRI are having problems with their balance. That they find that they have this condition. I don't know what the medical terminology is, but it's conditioned. But after the MRI, they've had trouble walking, Dick, because these affected some kind of something in their, something in maybe in their ear or whatever, that now they can't seem to walk correctly or feel that they don't have, in other words, they don't have the equilibrium. I wonder if you heard this, over.
KC2OES, comment.
KC2OES, I'm going to get to you in a second. Yes, I have, Mel. And even my wife, who had an MRI test, had temporary dizziness. It turns out that man is the main animal on this planet that does an extremely elaborate, complicated calculation. We take for granted what walking consists of. It's a very delicate balancing act. And all the computation required to do that balancing act has to be done in real time. And so just the sensing that takes place in the inner ear is part of it. Sometimes the sensing in the eyes are part of it. other sensing of the feedback you get from the feel in your feet as part of it, the feel of the knee joint and the hip joint. All of this is, all of that information is being fed into the brain in order for you to properly balance, walk, dance, whatever. Very complicated process. Every bit of that section of the brain has to be working correctly. And so you temporarily disturb any bit of that. And you're going to find out real fast when you try to walk. ET2, oh yes. I should know, but please tell me again your name and proceed with your comments, sir. My name is Dick.
Good evening, all. This is Fred. I have a two-part thing. I'm a welder, fabricator by trade, ironwork. One of the things that they ask, one of the questions that's usually asked, and I was a little curious as to why they asked it, but I finally figured it all out. To make a long story short, before you have an MRI, if you work in that field, they ask you that question because they don't want to put you in the machine and have a foreign metal object that might be embedded in your eyeball that you're not aware of, or your body, to be pulled further into your body or to a dangerous spot in your body, your brain, so on and so on.
Wow. Yeah, there was a case of where somebody made a mistake and put an oxygen bottle in the same room as an MRI machine. And during the examination of a patient, when the magnetic field was turned on, the oxygen bottle or a CO2 bottle, but one of these very large steel bottles, got sucked into the center of the machine where the patient was, and it created a fatality. It hit the patient at extremely high velocity, probably in some vital place like the head or whatever. So no magnetic materials are allowed to be within a large number of feet of distance of an MRI machine. MRI machine works with a very strong magnetic field. And yes, I can see how a piece of metal that could easily be embedded in, say, for instance, the eye, where it could be in an innocent spot, but you pull it into the retina and you could create partial blindness from it. I can see how that's possible. I think it's a long shot. But I can remember when I was 19 or 20 years of age going to college, an automobile passed me on the street very rapidly in Brooklyn, and a piece of material got picked up by the street and it got embedded into my eyeball. And being a young student and had this eye irritation, so to speak, I kind of ignored it. And within about 2 days, the piece fell out. It just embedded itself in the surface of my eye, not quite in the center of the eyeball, but in the black spot in the pupil, a little bit off to one side. I think it was a grain of sand, to be exact. And eventually it fell out. But I can see how a chunk of metal could easily be embedded into a person's eye. The eye doesn't have a great deal of feeling in some cases. And so it could penetrate, stay there for the rest of the lifetime. And I think you're saying that if you've been a welder, they don't want you put in an MRI machine, or they do some kind of a careful inspection of your body first before they do it. I can see situations where, in the case of a really bad automobile accident, they want to find out how much damage is present. They'd really like to do a diagnostic with an MRI. In that case, I guess you'd have to weigh the pros and cons. So what do you think, Fred? KC2OES, K2LAW.
W2PNJ.
Bob recognized, but Fred first. Go ahead.
I've had numerous eye injuries. They've always asked me the same question, if I had to take an MRI. Because I'm a welder, is one of the reasons of working with the iron. They just want to make sure that there's no metal objects in your eye that you're not aware of. And they do an eye exam. At least they have on me anyway. That's in the past history. I have had pieces of metal that have been in my eye, haven't realized it, and it might take a couple of days, and all of a sudden I'll wake up and my eyes start. I've also had radiation burns also from welding, which is called flash.
Now, let's go back on that one. If you're wearing the right kind of a safety mask, how did the radiation burn take place? Or was it on some part of the body where the mask was not located there, like your wrist or something like that? Now, back to you, Fred.
Well, it's kind of hard to describe to someone that doesn't do it for a living, but basically what happens is you open your eyes before the mask is fully down. You start the arc before the mask is fully down. And that instant of flash, if you do that more than a few times, you're going to wake up in the middle of the night with what feels like just tons of sand in your eyes. It's ungodly painful.
Now, that's not a that's not a good condition. I think you should try very hard to avoid that one, because I think it could do some eye damage. W2PNJ, you got it, Bob.
Interesting about MRI, when we do an electrical installation for these rooms that contain the MRI, all the recessed lights, all aluminum construction. In fact, the AC, we have to put in a DC converter to feed the filaments of those recessed bulbs that are in close proximity to that MRI, you know, because they need illumination, and they usually do it with recessed incandescent lights. And those filaments are running on DC to avoid the oscillations and the effect of the magnet on those filaments in those lamps.
You know, most fluorescent lights have a ballast transformer, which is a magnetic device. Do they do any special, do they go to an electronic ballast to get around that, or do they make sure that the ballast transformer is bolted down with a great big strap so that it can't possibly move? That's the next thing I would worry about, Bob. Go ahead.
On the installations that I have done, they don't use fluorescents. They use recessed incandescent bulbs, you know, hi-hats.
Yes, yes, yes. I should have. You did say incandescent. I didn't hear you. So they're running on DC so that there's no local magnetic field being created. Makes sense. By the same token, an electronic ballast on a fluorescent light, some of them run at around 60 kilohertz. So the an ordinary fluorescent lamp, you would see a 60-cycle flipper. It's actually a 120-cycle flicker from it. And in certain cases, when you're running near rotating machinery, you would see a stroboscopic effect of the machine rotating in front of that light. Whenever you see a dual fluorescent light, they usually set it up in such a way that when one bulb is on, the other is off, and they're flashing back and forth at a 60-cycle rate. That eliminates some of that effect. Well, in the case of a 60 kilohertz type electronic ballast, you've now got the plasma being formed and extinguished and reformed 60,000 times per second in that fluorescent bulb. If you're running a RFID reader, and if the RFID reader, stand by a second. If the RFID reader happens to be modulating itself, in other words, it creates side lobes that are turned on and off with the actual digital code from the RFID tag, radio frequency identification tag. And if that tag runs at a 60 kilohertz rate, the variation in reflectivity that you get from the fluorescent light can represent itself as a 60 kilohertz interference signal to the weak signal you want to listen to from the tag. So manufacturers of RFID readers have to make sure that they don't fall in their reading rate anywhere near the frequency of electronic ballast of fluorescent lighting. It's kind of funny how one technology can have an undesired or unanticipated impact on another technology. Okay, enough of this jazz. Let's hear about the Smith chart. K2KEY. Professor, you've got the floor. K2RIW.
WS21, one comment about the welding.
Yeah, go ahead. You've done a lot of welding also, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, two popular ways where that could happen, where you get the flash. Basically, when you're learning, you know, you're in a booth and you don't have that feel yet of getting your shield down just before you strike an arc. You know, you get the timing off, you know, so many times as you're learning, and sooner or later you're gonna miss. That's number one. And number two is usually the guy that's working with the welder tends to have the problem. I mean, he might eventually be a welder in the future, or he might even be a welder, but he's somebody that's maybe holding two pieces together, maybe a gusset plate in the case of Fred or me with maybe two pipes to here, just hold it. One guy's holding it, and then the other guy gets ready to flash it. The guy that's ready to tack it, tack weld it, he'll say to the guy, got it, and you're looking down, yeah, okay, and right before he does it, you don't close your eyes fast enough, you're dead in the water. And you don't necessarily, in fact, most of the time, that partner that's working with him will not have a shield on. Almost never. Back to you, Nick.
Yeah, what's really sad is that a friend of mine visited the country of Bangladesh, and he was in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh, walking up and down the street, and he saw a very bright flash coming from a number of these little booths on the side of the street where welding the opposite of welding was taking place, where they were disassembling parts, and it was being done by 13 and 14-year-old children without a safety mask. And, of course, they turned blind in a short period of time, and they just turned those kids out to the street to become beggars and go get more of them. They don't use a safety mask. And so how in the world that kind of a condition is allowed to persist is just amazing to me. There are certain portions of the world in which life is not considered to have very great value. In that exact same portion of the world, anyone who does tower work is not given a safety harness. And if he falls off the tower, you just go get another worker. There's a lot more than standing online ready to take his job. I don't understand that mentality, but certain portions of the world do that. Let's go to something much more present. Professor, K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY, yes. Final words on that. Bangladesh and a couple other places about environmental impact. Number one, Bangladesh, cut up a lot of old cargo boats, you know, cargo ships and whatever, wind up there. And one person I know that was involved for a while there, they were looking to buy materials, steel from them, scrap materials and all, went there and he just said he walked away holding his head. They were actually breaking the ships up with hammers, chisels, some use of acetylene torches, but mostly pan operation. All the oils, greases, everything was all over the place. The workers there had no safety hats, no goggles, not even shoes. They were working around all this iron and things, climbing around all this, not even with a pair of work boots. So that gives you an idea. Another one, if you want to see something, I just put up pictures of it, I believe, is where do you think all the automobile batteries, the lead-acid batteries, are winding up? Dick, do you have any idea? Over.
Are you telling me they end up there and people disassembling for the raw materials?
Oh, in China. There was a place in China, and they were showing how they have people working there under the most ridiculous conditions of the millions of batteries literally coming there by literally the boatload. And they come down a conveyor belt, and there's people sitting on either side of the conveyor belt with just like a rubber apron on, a hat of some material, a bandana thing wrapped around their face, and some of them were lucky enough to have some kind of eyeglasses on, and they're just sitting there, and as the batteries are coming, they're smacking them with hammers and breaking the cases. So they're acid is just going every which way. And they then take the casings just run off, and they're filling a hole in the mountain like this, like it was a big crater-like area, and they're just throwing the cases in there as that, and that's what they're salvaging the lead by that means, Dick, over.
Wow. And the impact that must have on the environment has got to be significant. So all that acid is essentially just dripping into the ground is what I think you're saying.
You should see what it's doing to the area. You can imagine how much acid, sulfuric acid, has been flowing out of these millions of batteries every year. This is still going on still to this day. That's the only place where you'll find processing of old automobile batteries. I was wondering, where the heck do they go? And that's where they're winding up, in China, over.
Well, I'd like to believe some of these conditions will eventually be corrected. There's got to be the equivalent of a worldwide environmental protection agency. It's just a matter of time before some of those areas of that part of the world become contaminated. I know that many of the organizations in the United States that used to build vacuum tubes were required to use some very exotic heavy metals to design the proper cathode. And for a while, various factories were just dumping that into the local soil until people in the nearby houses started getting sick. I think there's a place in Hicksville where, I can't think of the name, but Amperex used to be located. And I think that's now a contaminated piece of soil, and it's an empty factory. I wonder if that's still there. Back to you, Mill.
No, Roger. That's what one of the reasons that the number of these companies went out of business. For instance, the plating industry. There used to be a number of places here in Brooklyn that did copper plating, silver plating, and all that kind of, you know, I knew of one of a few of them that worked for me. And that plate all went out of business because they no longer could dump the, they used to clean the material, you know, clean the copper material first with arsenic. And after that, flush it down the sewer system, you know, whatever they used, the copper sulfate, everything. And, of course, the Environmental Protection Agency stopped them from doing that. And now they had to pay to have drums of air of this stuff removed. And the price was phenomenal because, God knows, I don't know where it had to go for processing, but it became such a problem that with infected constantly turning it, you know, they all closed up. There isn't a plate left here in Brooklyn, Vic, over.
And there's no good way around that either. I mean, when it comes to toxic fluid waste that contains heavy metals, where in the world do you dump it? For a period of time, various factories were dumping it back into the ground by having a phony well, a water well, to be fed backwards. It was just a matter of time before those toxic materials get into the adjacent well. And there have been a number of wells in Long Island that had to be closed down because of the chemistry that got into them, either from agricultural chemistry from a local farmer's field that drifted into the water supply. But if you really want to be a green person, you'd be slightly afraid of even putting weed killer on your lawn because some of those weed killers contain chemistry that, when it gets into the water table, is not good. Ain't easy to find a natural way of killing weeds without contaminating the environment. I guess that in itself is a kind of a tough thing to do. I think it's time we go on to a more pleasant subject there, like a Smith chart and a stub tuner. Mel, go ahead.
You're right, you can talk about this all night, getting away from basically amateur radio. Last week, if you remember, the question came in that this gentleman said, what was his name? I got his name here, Louis. Louis. And he says, I want to put up a 2-meter antenna in the back of my house, and I have a sort of a little hill that goes up on it, and I want to install the antenna there up on the top of the hill on a small tower. And I was able to get a couple of 100 feet of matching 75-ohm hard line, and I'd like to match it up with a 50-ohm system. Would you know how to go about making this stuff? So that was the question, approximately how long the stuff would be. If you remember, that was the question, Dick, over.
I sure do. And a minor thing we should discuss in the beginning is, according to Marino's book, I think it's 72 ohms is the impedance where a coax cable gives you the minimum insertion loss. So when you got cable TV, CATV hardline, not only is it extremely inexpensive, not only is it the lowest loss cable you can get for that diameter, with the exception of air-filled cable, and the air-filled cable is a lot more troublesome to use because you got to pressurize it with dry nitrogen. So of the foam-filled cables, it is very difficult to beat the insertion loss of 70 ohm CATV hardline. Is it 70 or is it 75 or is it 72? If it's 70 ohm and you connect it to a 50 ohm system, you got a 1.4 viswatt. If it's 75 ohm and you connect it to a 50 ohm system, you got a 1.5 viswatt instead of a 1.4. In either case, it's nothing to lose a lot of sleep about. In other words, the system will fly like a charm with that much standing wave ratio. And even though the cable's got some reflected signal on it, it's going to run a little bit higher in loss because of it. Because the cable you're using is so much lower in loss than anything else you can afford, you're still way ahead of the game. But for the purist, for the guy who's running moonbound, and he wants the last little bit of energy getting from his transmitter to the antenna, or vice versa, he wants the last little bit of energy coming in to be received by his low noise preamp and to see a perfect 50 ohm load. For that guy, for the scientist in us, Mel's about to teach us how to take that 1.4 or 1.5 as well and bring it down to a 1.0. You got it, Mel.
Gotcha. And basically, I was just going to say basically the same thing for the purists. Now, if basically what you were looking at, we're looking at, let's say, the 75 ohm CATV cable, and we're matching it then to a 50 ohm cable. Basically,